very happy to be here. Was ecstatic when Sonia asked me to come and talk to you all. So I would like to share my experience and the experience of our state health department in preparing an MMWR article related to the outbreak of HIV that Indiana experienced and continues to experience in the southeastern part of the state. I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'm just going to talk, but I did want to just share the backdrop of some pictures from Austin, Indiana, including some pictures of the needle exchange that the outbreak actually helped propel into existence. So when I see Pam Pontonis back there, so I'm going to give a plug for her presentation, which if you really want to hear about this outbreak, Pam is going to be doing a presentation on Wednesday morning where she will kind of take you through the epidemiology and the outbreak response efforts that are ongoing in Austin, Indiana. So in December of 2014, three people from Austin, Indiana were diagnosed with HIV at three separate facilities. And there were some very astute disease intervention specialists, which we called DIS, who quickly identified a common risk factor, which was injection of the prescription opioid, Opana ER. And I am using the name brand because, as we have learned, it was name brand Opana extended release. And so I don't want to include the generic versions because they were really not a part of this outbreak. And those DIS actually noticed that two of the individuals had a common needle sharing partner. So they did some great investigative work. Their contact tracing led to the identification and diagnosis of HIV in eight additional individuals by January 23rd, 2015. Where only five new HIV diagnoses had been made in the entire county during the previous 10 years, in the span of a single month, 11 individuals with injection drug use as a significant risk factor were diagnosed with HIV in this small, rural, southeastern Indiana community. The population of the community itself was 4,200 in a county of 24,000. So you all know that moment, right? That sinking feeling in your stomach when a situation really looks ominous, and that's where we were. By early February, it became clear that this wasn't an isolated group of individuals. The networks of people who injected drugs in this community were extensive and were overlapping. And we had a significant outbreak of HIV related to injection drug use of Opana ER. So we at the health department established regular meetings to strategize about our the outbreak response. And during one of those meetings, actually, we began a discussion about future publications so that we could share our experiences. Dr. Fried and I believe, had said that this was really the at that time the most significant outbreak of HIV in a rural area in the United States. So we knew that we needed to share this. So in and of itself a great exercise. So even if you never publish anything, getting together and talking about what you might like to publish really helps you frame your response. It helps you understand the data that you need to collect and sort of organize your thoughts around the outbreak. I was really interested in publishing in the MMWR. I had found MMWR articles to be really helpful. And I thought that that would be a great venue for sharing information with other public health officials at the state and local level. But there were a couple of problems. One, we didn't have accessible data at the time. And secondly, we just didn't even have any moments to breathe, right? As most public state health departments, understaffed, underfunded, and very, very busy with our response activities. So we worked closely with multiple federal, state, and local partners during our initial outbreak response, and the CDC actually sent an EpiAid team, and they were phenomenal. And then many other states, many of you probably in this room, shared DIS with us, allowing us to really expand the capacity of our DIS and to speed up the investigations. And that was very, very helpful. So with this increased investigation capacity, the numbers of people whose primary risk factor was injection of upon ER who were now infected with HIV climbed rapidly. And 1 week we diagnosed 22 individuals, actually. And I'm sure Pam is going to share the epi curve with you, and you'll see how that all unfolded. So this generated, as you can imagine, just a groundswell of interest with public health professionals and with the media. And so people were starting to publish about our outbreak and our response, and we hadn't yet done that. I knew, you know, I continued to think about this, and I knew I needed to do it, but, you know, I was teaching, and we were still doing Ebola hospital assessment visits, and working on this massive response, and then I had some personal illness in my family. It was just overwhelming to think about it. But on March 24th, I was on an Association of State and Territorial Health Officials call on a policy committee that I serve on. And the committee chair announced, it wasn't on the agenda, that Sonia and Charlotte Kent, who's the executive editor, would be joining the call to talk to us about how to get state information published in the MMWR. I'm like, oh gosh, you know, who told her? And as you can imagine, my ears just perked up. And Sonia and Charlotte began by saying, you don't really have to have a CDC co-author to publish. And they said that about 1 out of 5 MMWR articles published each week actually come from state and local health departments. And that hadn't really been my experience at the State Department of Health. Typically, it had been our EIS officers who had written the articles, and we had been co-authors, but they had taken the lead. So that was really good to hear. They mentioned the updated guidelines on the MMWR website. And so on the call, I immediately pulled those up on my computer and started reading. They expressed a special interest, as I believe Sonia mentioned, in reports with broad public health implications. And they suggested using the report to answer the questions, what's already known, what does this add to general knowledge, and what are the implications for public health? So as I listened, I knew that information about our outbreak was exactly what Sonia was talking about. And it just brought to mind one time in college, I was just taking a break from studying and silently contemplating, do I get that junk food out of the vending machine or not? You know how it is when you're taking a break. And the person sitting next to me, I had not said a word, just shouted, don't do it. I was like, what? Where did that come from? And I kind of felt like that, hearing Sonia and Charlotte. That was like the message I was getting, except they were saying, just do it. And so I really had no excuse at that point. And I was so motivated by their ask that I actually started writing the article on the call. So I don't think I listened to the rest of my policy committee meeting. I was busy writing, using the information from the website and also an article that had been previously published as a template. So we had some challenges early on in the outbreak investigation with the massive amounts of data that were being collected out in the field on paper forms and how to get those, you know, entered into computer databases and then databases that didn't talk to one another. So that the whole issue about understanding the data that we had around this outbreak, I think, really presented some challenges. And so as I was writing, I had to leave a lot of data placeholders. And at that point, we worked on getting the data in shape. But on April 7th, we actually got a call from the CDC. And previously, they had said, you know, we need to wait for the data. This call, they were like, we need to get this published as soon as possible. I'm like, okay, well, I have this draft. We used the data that we had. We scurried to finish the article. We circulated the drafts internally. And many of our colleagues added, subtracted, refined. And then we shared it with our CDC colleagues who were helping us with the investigation. And they did the same thing. And I felt like we had a really good product. And so this official clearance process that you've heard all about was going to be a breeze, right? So as everyone has said, voice of the CDC, you know, the subject matter experts there were more subject matter experts interested in our MMWR article than I even knew existed in the entire world, to be honest with you. And I can't even tell you how many people reviewed this. But what happened was the process, as Sonia described, it was sent to multiple people at the same time. So it was an exhaustive, and I don't mind saying an exhausting process. And I actually lost count of the number of revisions. And at one point, I had so many versions with so many different track changes and all those different colors that my computer actually crashed. And started giving me Chinese characters in the track changes comments. It was very tough, you know. Sometimes I'd be editing old versions before I realized it. And I tried to stay organized, but really, the information was flying fast. And so we worked closely with CDC and with the divisions of HIV, STD, Hepatitis C, with Sonia's office, and with our division of HIV and STD and our epidemiology staff and our DIS. And we actually moved from an unfinished draft to publication in under 3 weeks. But I got to tell you, we were working, you know, until midnight, waking up the next morning, additional comments, and really just an exhaustive process. So even 12 hours before this got published, and as you can imagine, over 3 weeks, our data was changing too. So trying to continuously update so that when we shared this information with you, it would be the most up-to-date information. So I was at a meeting in Atlanta, and it was a CDC, a meeting with ASTO and CDC, and I sat next to Sonia. I didn't know who she was. And I kept getting, you know, emails and texts and phone calls. And I said, oh, gosh, I'm going through the CDC clearance process. It's about ready to kill me. And she said, oh, hi, I'm Sonia. And she was very kind and extremely supportive during the process. And I'll also say that Karen Hoover from the Division of HIV Prevention at the CDC really held my hand and walked me through and kept me from exploding a couple of times. Because as you can imagine, you would get track changes that changed something you knew to be true to something that you weren't really sure what they were saying, and then somebody else at the same time was saying what you said. And you're like, okay, you know, here's what I said, here's what this person said what I said. So then you'd have to, like, have this discussion and really negotiate, actually, the language and the content material that you wanted. And I think that that dissent was good because it made me feel like if people within the CDC, these subject matter experts, can't agree on what should be said and how it should be said, then actually my voice is credible too. And so I felt empowered to really, I don't want to say fight, but to advocate for what I thought should be in the article. And I would encourage you all to do the same. And know when to bow out gracefully. That's important too. So I'll say that this really provided us with a well-respected platform for the timely release of what I thought was important information. And our article was published, early release, on April 24th. It was followed by a national press conference held jointly with CDC leadership and ISDH leadership. The print version followed on May 1st. And then there were many additional CDC publications that followed, were letters to journals critically evaluating our outbreak response. So when you do something like this, you really do throw yourself out there. As a result of this publication, we've really been able to have ongoing dialogue about our experience with academic partners and public health colleagues at the federal, state, and local levels. And I and other co-authors continue to receive requests for information, and we've had the opportunity to present at multiple local, state, and national, and even an international meeting. So the MMWR has recorded 9 citations in PubMed over the past year, which my husband, who's a research person, says is pretty good. We didn't have the ultimate metrics, which I'm very jealous if you publish in the MMWR. In fact, I may have to publish another article because it's such a cool tool. And I'm happy to say that many of my colleagues, or several of my colleagues at the State Department of Health, have proceeded to submit articles for publication since we've done this. So I think, you know, we're getting more comfortable with doing this, and I would encourage you to do that too. And I also would like to say that we in Indiana really appreciate, for those of you who have published in the MMWR, the information that you have shared with us. And we use that information every day as we face different kinds of outbreaks, as recently we did with our avian influenza outbreak. So thank you very much.
Questions for you?
Yeah. No, I can hear you.
So when you were going back and forth with the subject matter experts, I'm just curious about the actual logistics of that. Like, was everyone on one big email chain? Did they know that they were sometimes contradicting each other, or did you have to facilitate, you know, person A said this, person B is saying this, you guys need to, like, how does that actually work in practice?
Yeah, so it was, as Sonia described, that it got disseminated to these different subject matter expert groups at the same time. So there were multiple people on responses, but then there were multiple responses. So it got very complicated. And I have to say that I really relied on Karen Hoover to help me negotiate that back and forth between the different divisions at CDC. So I really do think that if you are intending on submitting something for publication, get in touch with somebody who will help you from the inside at the CDC. I think without that, I probably would have given up, to be honest with you, because it was a very arduous process. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So did you have a CDC co-author on this paper, or?
We did have CDC co-authors. So as I said, there was a large CDC presence in Scott County, and we really relied on them to connect our databases. You know, we had to work through this very, very quickly, and they brought some expertise that was invaluable. So they were co-authors on the article. But the actual writing of the article, I did most of the writing. There were others who, you know, kind of filled in, but lots of people helping to supply us with information. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Okay, well, thank you so much.